Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. A lesson on how to survive on foods found in the wilds of Central Park. How the recent pet food scare has implications for the human food supply. A trip up the central coast of California to visit the wine regions there. And speaking of pet food, what we feed this country's livestock might worry you. Jonathan Gold is back with a restaurant to try, but first, let's visit the area farmers markets to see what's in season this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. Spring is a good time of year to get back out into the garden, and there's a lot of new pests showing up. They must know when things are starting to bloom and be tender, because I know my things are covered with aphids. We're talking with Tom Peltier, and he has a stand at the market, Ladybugs Forever. He sells beneficial insects and critters to help control pests in your garden and in your yard. And you got a whole range of stuff, and now you've got worm castings, which is something kind of new. First of all, let's explain what a worm casting is. And then what it does.
Okay, worm castings is actually worm poop. The worm eats 5 to even 10 times its body weight every day. And what comes out in the end is all vitamins, minerals, amino acids, and all the good stuff to help your garden. And people don't realize, not only is it a powerful fertilizer, but it acts as an astemic and makes the plant taste terrible to the bugs. It's also an insect repellent against white flies, aphids, and spider mites. And most people get this on citrus trees and mostly hibiscus. Now, the best thing to do if your plant is covered with white flies, you want to do some pruning. Prune all the white cobwebby stuff off and then put out some worm castings. And then you can also make a tea out of the worm castings. And the way you do that, you take 1 cup of it and put it in a stocking or sock. Put that in a gallon of water for 24 hours. Take that solution and spray your plants with it. You also put it at the base of the plant, water it in.
Yeah, I can tell you I actually use this. I had a potato vine, and I used it on it. And literally, I used to be infested with whitefly, and I used some worm castings, and there were no more whitefly. And just real quick, let's see what else you have here.
This is a good time to put in snails, because this is the time the snails are laying their eggs. Every snail lays 2,000 eggs underground during their 2-year lifespan.
These are the bad garden snails.
The bad garden snails and the good snails also lay that many. And they will burrow under the earth within 24 hours and seek out the eggs of the other snail and eat them, and then eat the babies in the medium size. And
over a
period of time, they will take control. They're $15, mm-hmm. but that takes care of 200 square feet.
Forever, apparently.
Yeah.
Well, Tommy, it's nice to know that we have these natural alternatives and that there are good bugs that'll go get the bad bugs. So
that's right.
It's always great to check in with you at this time
of
year.
It's better not to poison your environment. Let nature take care of its own, and you're in much better shape.
That was Tom Peltier. His business is called Ladybugs Forever. He sells beneficial insects and snails to help control bad bugs in your garden and home. You can find Tom at LA Area Markets. He's at the Wednesday Santa Monica on Wednesdays, and he's at the Torrance Market on Saturdays. You can also find him alternating between the Studio City and the Hollywood Markets on Sundays. We're stopping now at the stand of Juan Acevedo. He is a person who works with Zuckerman Farm. In the asparagus season, Zuckerman Farm brings in beautiful asparagus. You're way up north in Stockton?
Yeah, in Stockton, Sacramento area. We hear only in season time is why the asparagus is excellent. In North California, a lot of rivers up there, asparagus need to drink water every time. It's why it's better flavor, color, green stuff. Jumbo size especially is excellent flavor. After 2 years, cut off and put new plants.
Oh, really?
Tender and sweeter.
On your jumbo asparagus.
Jumbo side.
Oh, that's interesting, because mm-hmm. I know asparagus plants live for up to 15 years. And now tell me what happened. I know something bad happened to your purple asparagus this year.
Well, some guys about 2-3 years ago make big mistake. Cut off everything, including plants, purple plants.
So they were like disking or something? And they just cut down all mm-hmm. the purple. So when are you going to have that again?
We don't know yet.
Couple years?
Maybe 2 or 3 more years.
Oh, that's so sad. Because everybody, when you come, they say, where's the purple asparagus? Because asparagus takes a couple years to get mature, but then you can harvest it for years and years and years. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, do some of your customers peel their asparagus
well,
before they cook it?
Well, some people like peel, but not needed.
Just cut off
in the bottom a little bit, 1 inch in the bottom, and the rest, very thin.
Okay. Sweet. When I bring asparagus home, I know we put it in a plastic bag. Should we leave it in a plastic bag in the refrigerator?
No, leave it non-plastic
open.
Bag.
How about putting the ends in water? Sometimes people do that.
Tupperware container, and little water, little bit, not much.
But in the refrigerator?
In the refrigerator.
Oh, okay.
Keep fresh for longer.
And then how long? About a week, do you think?
More than a week, for sure.
All right, Juan. Well, it's great to have you. Now, how much longer will the asparagus be in season?
Well, 5 or 6 weeks, depending on the weather.
Thank you. We love your asparagus. That was Juan Acevedo, and he works with Zuckerman Farm. Zuckerman are a grower of asparagus and lots of potatoes, and they bring the asparagus to the Wednesday market. You'll find Zuckerman also at the Saturday Pico Market and at several Southland markets. Don't forget, this coming Thursday, May 10th, we're going to be having our second library panel featuring farmers from the Santa Monica Farmers Market and local chefs. Chris Blobaum from Wilshire Restaurant is going to be our featured chef. Chris Blobaum's Wilshire Restaurant is a sustainable restaurant from top to bottom. And all three panelists are going to be talking about how important it is and how challenging it is to grow and live sustainably in Los Angeles. So again, this coming Thursday, May 10th, 7 to 9 p.m. at the Martin Luther King Auditorium in the Santa Monica Main Library. And Chris Blobaum will be serving food from Wilshire at the conclusion of the event. So hope to see you there. It's free and open to the public. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Pulitzer Prize-winning restaurant critic Jonathan Gold is with me next. He's got another place for us to try. That's when Good Food continues. Once again, it can't be Saturday morning without Jonathan Gold bringing us to somewhere truly special to eat. Jonathan Gold being, of course, the author of countless LA Weekly counterintelligence columns and now a Pulitzer Prize winner to boot. So where are we going today? Here, this one is pretty funny.
We are going to Hikko Sushi.
And what is Hikko Sushi known for?
Hikko Sushi is known for sushi. As you might have guessed.
As I might have guessed. But is it, you know, is there some sort of extra thing?
There are several things that LA Sushi is known for. One is the sort of celebrity aspect of it, which this might have. Movie stars have been seen at this place, even though it's a very unassuming place in a mini mall.
Where is it, by the way?
It's in West Los Angeles, in the shadow of the 10405 interchange. And LA Sushi is known for strange combinations, which this place doesn't do. But LA Sushi is also known for, how do we put this nicely, autocratic sushi chefs.
Autocratic sushi chefs. Seinfeld might call them the sushi Nazis.
He might. I wouldn't.
Because you'd like to continue eating in them.
Exactly so. In a town filled with sushi autocrats, you know, famously at Sushi Nozawa and at Sushi Sasabune, he might be possibly the most demanding of them all.
And what is it he wants us to experience that makes him so autocratic in his presentation?
You eat what he serves you. If you sit at the sushi bar, you don't get to order. If you sit at a table, you can order. There are big signs saying you're not allowed to have cell phones in the restaurant.
I think for many people, the scariest part of putting themselves in this position is money, is not knowing where you're going to end up at the end.
It's always mysterious. And I must say, though, even though you walk into Hikko Sushi and it looks like an inexpensive sushi place in every possible way, there are nice paintings on the walls, but that's kind of it. It's not cheap. I mean, it can cost $150 for two if you're reasonably hungry and thirsty.
So do you usually sit at the bar and just accept what is given?
I do.
And what is given?
The first few dishes are inviolate. They are always the same, even if there's one that's not your thing. You'll start off with a big bowl, like almost a cereal bowl of chopped tuna in really tart ponzu sauce. Mm. And your second course will be yellowtail sushi. And your third course will be snapper sushi. And if you say, oh, the Japanese Thai, he'll like, if he looks at you at all, he'll sort of like grunt and say, no, Japanese Thai is farmed. And I serve only wild fish at the restaurant. So you're in good hands. The fourth one is albacore sushi, which is not seared at the edges. It's raw and has a real soft texture. And the thing that all of these courses, except for the first one, have in common is that he uses very, very hot rice. Some places use warm rice. His is hot. It's delicately seasoned, so you really, really taste the rice. It's loosely packed, and the fish itself is surpassingly soft. So when you pop it into your mouth in one bite, because if you try to do it in two bites,
it'll
collapse. The effect is of, you know, this beautiful hot rice with the fish melting around it almost like a sauce. And it's extraordinary. And he's the only person who's I've ever had quite that experience with.
It sounds wonderful.
If you get past the crab roll is a sign of, you know, a certain generation of LA sushi chefs, then, you know, you might get different things. Like, he'll do a sea bass. He'll give you two pieces, one with a piece of seaweed on it, which is very tart, and the one without. It's sort of looking at a painting from two different directions. You see different things in it, and you see different flavors in the sea bass. There's a really beefy toro sushi. Sometimes, if you're really lucky, he'll do the salmon eggs. You know how they're usually sort of soft and sticky? These aren't sticky, and they're turgid. I mean, they just
pop.
Burst. They pop in
oh,
your
I
mouth.
I love that.
And it's an extraordinary sensation.
Oh, that sounds really, really wonderful. Something not to be missed. So give us once again the name of this sushi place and the address.
The name of the place is Hiko Sushi, and it's at 11275 National Boulevard in Los Angeles.
Jonathan Gold's the Pulitzer Prize winner for food criticism this year and a frequent guest on Good Food. You can read him each week in the LA Weekly. Go to our site for links at kcrw.com/goodfood. In our urban environment, we walk past plants creeping up through the cracks in the sidewalk all the time. But some of those plants are edible, even delicious. I'll be back next with an urban forager who's found the edible fauna of New York's Central Park and even been arrested for it. That's when Good Food continues. Imagine foraging for nettles or chickweed, for coffee or cherries through New York's urban landscape. Impossible, you say? Well, not for our next guest. Wild man, as he's known, Steve Brill is an environmental educator. He teaches his charges to seafood in the many oases of parks that dot the New York landscape. It's so great to talk to you, Steve. I'm sorry we interrupted you cooking.
Oh, that's fine. I love to cook, and you're not going to stop me.
We don't want to stop you. Is there anything to be found in Central Park right now, or do you have to wait until spring really springs forth?
I had a tour in Central Park 2 weeks ago, and there are things that are in season all year. A tree called sassafras, which is not tolerant of shade and often finds itself growing under taller trees and dies, therefore makes thousands and thousands of saplings. And the saplings will die unless they happen to be growing in full sunlight. So we go into an area that's semi-wooded, and we collect the saplings. You wash those off and simmer them for about 20 minutes, and you have a delicious tea that the Indians used as a spring tonic. If you chill the tea and add some chilled sparkling water and a sweetener, you have your own root beer. You can also scrape the outer layer of the root after you've washed it and use that in place of cinnamon. It makes a wonderful exotic seasoning. Last thing I made with it after Central Park was sassafras ice cream.
Now, Steve, did you teach yourself to recognize all of these wild foods? Has it been a really long, slow learning process for you? Or had you taken courses elsewhere and then realized that it was all right there in New York for you to find and teach to others?
I looked high and low for courses, and there weren't any. So I had to teach myself. And I used books that had pictures that were taken from wildflower books and really didn't show you what the edible plants look like at the season when you want to eat them, and basically learned on my own over a period of years. Then I thought it might be a good idea to try teaching some classes, and 25 years ago I led my first foraging tour. I happened to be in Central Park, and I've been doing that ever since.
Are your best groups children or adults?
I work more with children than adults. And kids absolutely love learning about nature. They have nothing connecting them with their local ecosystems. When they watch nature on TV, it's always animals, which are much less plentiful than plants and usually don't like it when you take them out of their habitats and eat them. The wild plants that we pick are renewable resources. In other words, people consider them weeds. They're so prolific. And we evolved on these very common plants for millions of years before the first Big Mac slithered down the assembly line. So we are adapted biologically to eating these very nutritious and very tasty foods.
What is the best time for the most variety? And give us an inkling of what would be picked and eaten during those tours.
Well, the most variety you have in the fall, because that's when all the nuts are in season and you have the greatest number of mushroom species. You have some berries and some herbs and greens, and all the roots are in season. The roots are also in season in early spring when you get the cold-resistant vegetables like field garlic and chickweed. Chickweed is one that tastes like corn on the cob. Mid-spring is the best time for vegetables and edible flowers, and summer is the best time for the largest quantity of berries.
What are some of the mushrooms that you've found in Central Park?
Basically everything. 2 weeks ago it had rained, and even though it was winter, we found oyster mushrooms. Those are quite good, but you have to be careful with them too. One of the tour participants who thought he knew the mushrooms really well, his name was Joe, had moved to Connecticut, and it had rained, and he was driving down the road in his car. He stopped the car there on a dead tree on a lawn by a big house where 10 pounds of these oyster mushrooms, very delicious, not hard to identify once you've seen them once or twice. And he ran across the lawn past the house with his pocket knife and a paper bag, cut down the mushrooms, started going back to the car, closed the door and took off home with a big smile on his face until 5 minutes later the state police came after him. Turned out he had been seen running across the lawn, the home of the warden of the state prison, carrying a knife. So they thought he was trying to kill the warden. So we get oyster mushrooms, chicken mushrooms, hen of the woods, honey mushrooms, puffballs, wine caps, Dreifaria mushrooms. We've found some very effective deadly amanitas. Sometimes someone has a boss they don't like. And that gives you 12 hours to leave the country before the symptoms appear.
Thank you very much for taking the time out of your busy cooking schedule to talk to us.
Sure, it's been a pleasure.
Stephen Wildman Brill is a botanist, naturalist, and forager who runs walking tours in Manhattan. Links to his site and pictures of his edible finds are on our site at ksrw.com/goodfood. Touring musicians spend a lot of time on the road. When you're on the road, you have to eat, and most of the food off the interstate is of the fast variety. Next, foraging for food when you're on the back of a bus. That's coming up on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com.
Thank you.
KCRW, this very radio station where I work, is an extraordinary place. Every week, incredible musicians stalk the halls waiting to go on the air live with various DJs. I've always wanted to get them in my studio and ask food questions, but it seems that a music writer from Brooklyn, Kara Zwaro, scooped me with her book, I Like Food, Food Tastes Good. And what a great title that is. Welcome to the show, Kara.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
The bands that you're talking about and the food you're talking about, these aren't bands that travel with huge entourages and have private chefs cooking for them while they're on the road, are they?
No, not at all. In most cases, they're traveling in vans that they're driving around themselves, and they're cooking for themselves or just eating fast food on the road.
So a lot of this food that you describe is food that they eat when they're off the road.
A lot of them are kind of homecoming recipes. There are a few that are tour food. A couple of sandwiches, like Death Cab for Cuties, veggie sausage and peanut butter sandwich, is something they make at other people's houses along the way.
Veggie sausage and peanut butter sandwich. Now, when you first heard that, were you disgusted?
A little bit. But the band was so excited about it that I went home and tried it, and I was pretty surprised. It wasn't nearly as bad as it sounds.
Is the sausage hot?
Yeah, you kind of fry up the sausage and you toast the bread. The peanut butter kind of melts and it's almost like a Thai kind of flavor with the spice of the sausage and the peanut butter.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. So let's start with breakfast, because when I think about a rock band eating breakfast, I think about a bunch of really hungover people, not necessarily from drink, but from just long hours and the downside of the adrenaline rush of performing.
The interesting thing is that breakfast sometimes happens at like 4 o'clock in the morning after the club closes. You know, it's not really a great idea to cook something elaborate at 4 o'clock in the morning. People are tired. People are going to pass out. So there are a couple of simple recipes. And then there are some more elaborate ones if you can kind of hold out till the next day and make a big brunch around noon.
So let's talk about cheesy sleazy.
That comes from Silkworm. And actually, the person who contributed the recipe, unfortunately, passed away in a car accident.
Oh, that's
shortly
really
after he contributed.
Sad.
It is really sad, but I've been in touch with the rest of the band, and I think for them, it's been kind of a fun experience because they hadn't seen the recipe. He emailed it to me, and it's actually about having breakfast with one of his bandmates every weekend. And, you know, I think it was just a nice memory for them to hold on to. So, you know, it's a big, greasy meal. It's refried beans, eggs. You know, if you have some breakfast sausages and some peppers, it's kind of like throw in anything that you want. Toast. It's really a lot of food, but it really does soak up a hangover and is kind of a bonding experience.
There's band Bling Kong. Their recipes are really interesting to me because they seem so mom sort of based. Before we get into the food, could you describe the kind of band that Bling Kong is?
Yes, Bling Kong is, there are many, many members in the band. The stage really gets filled up. They have a few drummers, a few guitars. Sometimes there's a horn section. There are always three cheerleaders, and it's almost like a down and dirty marching bands kind of thing. So it was very funny when one of the cheerleaders sent me this sort of homemaker style recipe that involves Pillsbury Crescent rolls.
Now, what's the story of her making this recipe?
Well, it was the same kind of thing where, you know, they'd have some late nights and they'd kind of get together for brunch the next day. Her reason for going with the Pillsbury is because her grandmother has been a finalist in the Pillsbury Bake Off contest on the side of the tube of the Pillsbury buns. So she had hoped to do the same thing, to kind of follow in her grandmother's footsteps.
Describe the recipe for us.
You make some bacon, and you're kind of lining a casserole with crescent rolls. And then you're putting in bacon, apples, and eggs, and fold the rolls over so you get kind of a breakfast casserole that has this pot pie sort of look.
That sounds delicious.
It's pretty delicious.
Because you've got the sweet, the buttery, and the salty all at once. Ooh, I'm going to have to try that one.
Yeah.
And I have to ask you, how many of these recipes have you ended up folding into your actual eating repertoire?
I've really gone back to a lot of the desserts. The banana pudding has become a favorite in my family, and that's from the Drive-By Truckers, one of my favorite bands.
Describe Drive-By Truckers.
Well, the Drive-By Truckers are kind of like an old school Southern rock band, but they're also very liberal in their politics. So it's kind of like if Lynyrd Skynyrd were voting for Hillary Clinton, this might sound like the drive-by truckers. And they do have a song called Sinkhole, which mentions banana pudding.
And what is the lyric?
The idea of the song is that the landlord is coming to repossess the family farm because they don't have enough money. Basically, the man of the house, and this is, you know, this is a pretty old school Southern idea. In the song, he kills they kind of feed him his last supper, which includes some banana pudding. And then he kills him and then goes to church on Sunday and doesn't feel bad about it.
Buries him on the farm. They get to keep the farm and everyone moves on. What a great
song. But before he dies, they give him some good banana pudding.
Kara's really a fun book. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
That was Kara Zwaro. She's a music writer from Brooklyn, and her book is I Like Food, Food Tastes Good, In the Kitchen with Your Favorite Bands. Foraging for food takes another meaning when your family doesn't know where your next meal's coming from. There's food banks, as we know, all over the country, set up to assist the poor or the working poor. But what's given out at those food banks? I'll be back next on Good Food with a journalist who lived on food handouts for a week. Stay tuned. Do you ever wonder what it would be like to live on handouts, to not have your world of the grocery store, Trader Joe's, and Whole Foods define your culinary choices? Kimberly Lord-Stewart did. She's the author of Eating Between the Lines, a book that focuses on the hidden holes in food labeling. After helping out with her church's food drive and in preparation to write Eating Between the Lines, Kim, her husband, and her teenage son Ian agreed to live on food rations for 1 week. The food they received was from a nonprofit food bank in their hometown that distributes food to 90 agencies. They had a very particular experience. But before we begin, I'd like to state that the following discussion in no way represents the quality of food at our very own Los Angeles Regional Food Bank. The LA Food Bank inspects all food that's received, all expiration dates are checked, and they weed out any food that's unacceptable. 80% of the produce is usable, and any produce that isn't usable is discarded. The LA Food Bank has nutritionists on staff, and all agencies that they distribute to must be certified for safety. So having said that disclaimer about our local situation, Kim, let's go ahead and start with what were some of the self-imposed ground rules that you made for eating for the week?
For all three of us, for my husband and my son, we could accept no lunch or dinner invitations from friends to eat out or eat at their homes. We could spend absolutely no money on food. So with those rules, I went to the food bank in our local area. And this is a food bank that agencies go to collect food, and then they distribute it in smaller facilities. So when I started this, I grabbed my shopping cart and sort of had that same mentality that you do when you go in the grocery store. I'll just pick out what I would normally eat for the week. And when I got there, many of the shelves were empty. Bread became a huge problem. I grabbed the last loaf on the shelf, and by the time I got it home, it was moldy. And about 2/3 of it was moldy. I didn't really look at the package as I would in a grocery store. You just grab it off the shelf, put it in your cart, and off you go.
Now, did you find that there was more selection in terms of sweets?
Yes, there were lots of pastries. There were lots of donuts, cakes, cookies. There were no whole grain products.
And what about oil for cooking?
I was handed a gallon jug of oil that was supposed to be for popping popcorn. And we think of it as movie popcorn oil. It was butter-flavored oil, and about 20% of it was made with hydrogenated fats.
Aside from the health issues of the hydrogenated fat, Was the flavor so odd that you couldn't use it?
I didn't use it. I opened it, I looked at it, I smelled it, I took a little taste, and I realized that even given my situation, this would be one of the products I just couldn't bring myself to eat or feed my family.
Did you ask them whether or not people indeed did take this oil and use it?
Yes, they did. This was a common item that they would distribute.
Wow. So tell us what a typical dinner would be that you prepared.
Let me start with what I had that was fresh. I really pride myself at home on cooking well and using a lot of fresh ingredients. I had a few apples, one squash, one onion, and a bag of potatoes. And I did find a bag of lettuce, the pre-washed lettuce, but when I got it home, again, this was also spoiled. So that was all I had for fresh. I had some canned vegetables, some canned chicken. I had 1 pound of ground hamburger, a lot of tofu hot dogs, which my son had a real problem with. I did find some salmon steaks, and we saved those for the last night. But in general, most of our foods were based on canned food items. So I would take a can of tuna fish, for instance, mix it up with some plain rice and some sour cream and sort of turn it into sort of a tuna casserole.
And how did your family fare on the diet?
My husband is very thin, and he lost 5 to 10 pounds during the week, and it's weight that he just can't afford to lose. By midweek, I was sick. I have an autoimmune disease, and by midweek, I was very sick. I have health insurance. I went into my doctor and said, "How is this experiment I'm on contributing to my health?" And she said, "Well, it isn't a cause, but it certainly triggered some immune reactions in your body. You're not used to eating these types of foods, high in sugar, high in refined carbohydrates, no fresh fruits or vegetables." So she said it was a contributing factor.
If you had really been in this situation, would you have also had some sort of government food coupon to supplement the items that you got from the food banks?
It would depend on my income level. When I called the officials in Boulder County and said, "Tell me how prevalent this problem is," they said there's a lot of people who don't qualify for food stamps. They make just a little too much money, but usually by about the third week of the month, they run out of money and they end up in the food pantries.
What would be the maximum annual income that would allow you to qualify?
It varies by community, it varies by state, but in my area, it's about $24,000 for a family of four.
Wow.
Okay.
Now, you had a lot of conversations with different people who work in social services and food bank experts. What did they have to say in terms of this problem of hunger nationally? Did they perceive that there's any sort of solution to it?
The solution goes beyond our food. There are about 12 million people in this country on any given day who are food insecure. And it doesn't really have anything to do with availability of food or the quality of food, but it has to do with larger issues such as housing. It has to do with the availability of even grocery stores. I work with a small school in Denver made up of mostly kids who live on a daily basis with these struggles. And there isn't even a grocery store in this community that's within walking distance. So their families rely on convenience stores to buy most of their food, or they rely on fast food restaurants.
What did you personally learn about hunger?
The last day of the experiment, I ended up in the soup kitchen. I think often we think of these people as taking advantage of the system, but many of them were very gracious and very kind and very grateful for the help that they received, and that was a big surprise for me.
My guest, Kim Stewart, experienced handouts in her home of Denver, Colorado. We spoke with the LA Food Bank, who assured us the quality of their food is much higher than what Kim experienced. The LA Food Bank inspects all food that's received. All expiration dates are checked, and they weed out any food that's unacceptable. To find out more about the LA Food Bank, go to our website at kcrw.com/goodfood. The recent pet food scare that resulted in many animal deaths got me worried about our human food supply. We already saw how widespread the damage can be from just a small amount of contaminated spinach. I'll be back next with noted food educator Marion Nessel about the way we feed ourselves and our pets. That's in 1 minute right here on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Finally, that a new conversation is underway about the links between the dangers of our industrialized food supply and how we eat. One person responsible for getting this conversation going is Marion Nessel. This remarkable woman is the Paulette Goddard Professor of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University. Her degrees include a PhD in molecular biology and an MPH in public health nutrition. And although Marion's written a lot about our food supply in the past, her latest book, What to Eat, seems to have struck a chord with both the media and the public. Hi, Marion.
Hi.
With all these recent issues about food safety, I thought that we could sort of take a look at the idea of safe food. You know, I think about this pet food scare and imagine what would happen if it were people dying with kidney problems instead of all those kitties and puppies out there.
Well, it's only one small step to that, because the extraordinary thing about the pet food recall is what is unfolding even as we speak. The idea that the recalled pet food got fed to pigs, for example, I think is really amazing. Certainly not something that I would have expected. And the pigs are being now found to excrete the same substance that's been found in the pet food that they think might have something to do with the toxicity, although they really don't know.
Whose idea was this to feed the food to pigs?
Well, I guess this is standard practice in the industry. If you've got recalled pet food, you've got to do something with it. So you feed it to pigs.
This is just amazing to me, because when you think about the problems of animal excretion, I mean, that's what gave us the E. coli with spinach.
Indeed, it did. And the analogy between the spinach recall and the pet food recall is a very tight one. The issues are really quite the same. We don't have farm-to-table food safety requirements in this country, so that spinach farmers are not required to grow food under safe food conditions. You just hope that they do. And the same thing is true of pet food. Pet food is regulated, but rather loosely, and nobody has looked at ingredients.
And I would imagine that the whole globalization of the food supply makes hunting down problems after the fact all the more difficult, which we can see from this pet food scare.
Well, what we see, first of all, is that the Chinese government at first refused to allow the Food and Drug Administration to go visit the factories. There are reporters all over China trying to track this down. And, of course, there's this question floating around, was the ingredient deliberately contaminated in order to make it look like it had more protein? That's the leading hypothesis right now. This is an old trick that used to be done with farm feeds, and it's one of the reasons why the FDA got involved in regulating farm feed.
Unbelievable. What is the situation right now with the FDA and oversight and regulation? I heard an interview recently with a gentleman from the FDA who just says they're so underfunded by this administration that it's a joke to think that they could possibly continue the very small level of oversight that they're supposed to have.
Well, I'm amazed that somebody from the FDA actually said that in public, but it is absolutely and completely true. Congress, in its infinite wisdom, has systematically taken resources away from the FDA in the last 10 or 15 years under the philosophy that business doesn't like to be regulated, and so let's not regulate it. Let's leave it up to business to take care of regulation voluntarily. And so even after 9/11, when new resources were put into the FDA in order to prevent food bioterrorism, the FDA's oversight for inspection increased. It doubled, which sounded really exciting, except that it doubled from 1% to 2% of the foods coming into the food supply. The FDA really can't do anything because every single penny that comes into it is earmarked for a specific congressionally mandated problem. And if you don't like this situation, the people you have to talk to about it are your congressional representatives because they're the ones who did this.
Now, of all the foods that we're told that we should eat, which of these foods are in fact the most dangerous because of contamination problems?
Well, I guess what you're referring to is vegetables. I mean, it used to be that most of the bacterial contamination of foods happened with meat. But in the mid-1990s, the USDA, which regulates meat, required the producers of beef and chicken and poultry to follow standardized food safety regulations. And as a result, the amount of contamination of meat products has declined, whereas it has increased in vegetables. And part of that has to do with the fact that we do not require vegetable producers to follow food safety procedures. We rely on them to do it voluntarily. And the really good producers will do it voluntarily. I've visited farms in Salinas that I think are producing vegetables under the most outstanding food safety procedures you could ever imagine. But others don't necessarily do that because it costs more.
Now, with all of this happening right now, and you know, as usual, we have a sense that what we hear is just the tip of what's percolating out there. Are there any rules for us for shopping and cooking that can just make us feel better about keeping our food safe at home?
Well, there are, and these are what I call the individual responsibility rules, and they are to cook your foods, to keep hot foods hot and cold foods cold, to separate raw foods from cooked foods, those kinds of standard, you know, keep your kitchen surfaces clean and wash your sponges in the washing machine every now and then, you know, I mean, sort of obvious things so that you don't contaminate food that's okay with food that isn't okay. Cooking takes care of a lot of problems. And that's why the spinach episode was so disturbing, because a lot of people eat spinach raw.
Thank you so much, Marianne. As always, you are a font of information.
A pleasure to be here.
That was Marianne Nessel. Her book, What to Eat, is now in paperback. And take a look at her previous books as well, Food Politics and Safe Food, Bacteria, Biotechnology, and Terrorism. Since we're talking about some troubling methods in the way our food supply is constructed, there's another area to look at, what we feed the animals that become our food. Next, an environmental lawyer may make you want to stop eating animals altogether. That's coming up on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Saying you are what you eat, but with food becoming ever more industrialized, it makes sense to understand that we're what the animals eat, too. Nicolette Hahn-Nyman is an environmental lawyer who recently wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times on the conditions in pig farms here in the U.S. She and her husband, Bill Nyman, are also cattle ranchers. Is there still some kind of an invisible link between us and the food we eat about which we know practically nothing?
Yes, there is. And I call the feed industry, the animal feed industry, the invisible link in our food chain, because it's a huge industry. It's about a $25 billion industry, but it's something that consumers have almost no access to as in terms of finding out information about it.
Now, is animal feed regulated at all?
It is regulated, but the regulations in the United States are pretty relaxed. And so there are tons of ingredients that an ordinary consumer would probably not want in their food, and they are allowed. For example, arsenic is a very common additive to both chicken feed and often to pig feed. And that's done because it actually makes the animals hungrier, and so they eat more and they get to market faster. But it is an additive that is not allowed in the European Union because there are both human health concerns and environmental concerns about using arsenic.
What are some of the other bizarre and sort of unpalatable ingredients one might find in animal feed?
Well, one that consumers probably have heard something about is up until 1997, it was very common to add slaughterhouse waste to cattle feed, to beef cattle and dairy cattle, pigs, chickens. It was very commonly added to all different kinds of animal feeds. In 1997, the FDA put some restrictions on doing that for cattle feed because of concerns about mad cow disease. But they didn't go far enough, and there's still a number of types of animal byproducts that can be added to cattle feed, and slaughterhouse waste can still be fed to pigs and chicken, and still is.
What about poultry manure?
Yep, that one surprises a lot of people, but that is a very common additive as well. In fact, the poultry manure issue came into sort of a little bit under public scrutiny because there was some public outcry about the fact that chicken manure, chicken waste, is allowed to be fed to cattle. And at first, the FDA said, well, we're going to disallow that now. But then the beef industry protested so vehemently because they said, well, this is something we really need. It's a good, cheap protein source. And the chicken industry protested because they said, well, then we've got nothing to do with our chicken waste. So chicken litter is still being fed to cattle today in the United States and other species as well. In fact, it's often used on fish farms as well.
What about foods that are labeled, foods like beef that we buy that is called organic? Are they allowed to be fed these kind of feeds as well?
No, the feeds are much more restrictive on organic animals. It's not quite as restrictive as some people might think. For example, dyes are permitted and, in fact, very commonly used, for example, in organic fish, salmon. That's why it looks so pink. So the word organic is not totally protective as far as telling you what's in the feed, but it does put quite a few restrictions on it.
What about antibiotics? Are they still being used in large amounts in the feed?
Yes, and it's a huge number. It's about half of all the antibiotics used in this country every year that are fed to animals. And the reason that's problematic is because it's being shown by a number of studies, it's been very widely documented actually, that that's contributing to the rise of diseases that are resistant to antibiotics. So the World Health Organization, the American Medical Association, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, all of these organizations have come out and said, you know, the industry has to stop doing this with antibiotics, but there has been very little change.
People who are concerned about this and who are hearing about this for the first time, this idea that animals are being fed a whole host of things over which we have no control and very little knowledge, what can concerned people do about this?
When you're at a grocery store, and I would simply begin asking the question, how was this animal raised? What was this animal fed? And same thing if there's a restaurant that you regularly go to. You know, my husband and I never order meat in a restaurant without first finding out where it's from. And if the waiter doesn't know the answer to the question, we always ask the waiter to go ask the chef. And if the chef doesn't know the answer, then we do not order it. And what we have found is that when we begin asking the questions, and we've been encouraging our friends to ask these questions, it makes people go and learn the answers. And when people start asking the questions and learning the answers, and they don't like the answers that they're getting, then they begin asking their suppliers to change their practices, or they start looking for other suppliers. So I think it has this tremendous ripple effect when the consumer just begins asking the question.
Nicolette, very interesting conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Nicolette Hahn-Nyman is an environmental lawyer and the wife of Bill Nyman of Nyman Ranch. Nyman Ranch produces humanely ranched beef and pork products. If I haven't depressed you entirely, it's time to go have a glass of wine. Everyone knows Napa as a California wine-growing region, but the central coast of California is practically undiscovered. I'll be back next with a tour of some of the wineries and a guide to the towns and grapes. That's next on Good Food. Everyone knows about Napa in California. The name connotes the best of California's wineries. But wait, there is another fantastic wine region in California called the Central Coast. We're talking about towns like Templeton, Paso Robles, and Los Olivos. And the great thing about living in LA is that all these places are either day trips or a really great weekend away. Mira Advani Honeycutt is a freelance journalist who spent the last couple of years immersing herself in the Central Coast food and wine scene. Her research is captured in her new book, California's Central Coast, The Ultimate Winery Guide. Welcome, Mira. It's so great to have a guide like this now. What makes some of these places really good growing regions?
Central Coast is blessed with cool night air and warm days. Some of the best grape regions, if you see, have the temperature. In Paso Robles alone, you will have 90 degrees in the daytime, and the temperature can drop to between 40 and 50 at night.
Wow.
So you don't find a temperature like that anywhere in California. And that makes the grapes, especially Pinot Noir, you know, the Santa Rita Hills Pinot Noir, which is warm in the day, cool at night. These grapes love this kind of climate. As you go inland, it's very warm, good for Cabernet, good for Syrah, good for Zinfandel, and other Bordeaux varietals. So we're very fortunate to have all these different varietals in this region.
When did this burst of wineries in the Central Coast really start happening?
It really started, I would say, around the 70s, but it was a bit slow. But I noticed myself around, mid-90s. When it just really started popping.
And where there started to be nice places to stay,
yes.
Good places to eat.
Right, right. A lot of chefs are going there now, and you have charming B&Bs. And the Paso Robles region, I mean, I have literally seen it just burst in the last 3 years.
So let's go there first. And because it's just far enough away from L.A. to make it be a really long day trip, let's spend a weekend.
I would spend a weekend there, and I would go stay at the Paso Robles Inn, which is beautiful, charming, historic place right in the historic town square. I always said hit about 3 wineries a day, no more than that. And then the way Paso Robles is set, you have the east side wineries, you have the west side wineries, then you have the far out wineries, which are on Adelaide Road. So once you're there, you just want to do that region. And then you have a small little group of wineries called the Backcountry Road Wineries, which are tucked away in little country roads. So let's say we start on Highway 46 East, which is like the main thoroughfare, and you've got the big monuments to Bacchus there, you know, big wineries like Robert Hall, Eos, Eberle. So you would, let's say, and Martin and Weyrich. Those are the 4 or 5 big ones. Martin and Weyrich, you can stop by there, have some great Italian varietals. They have some very good Nebbiolos, and they have a charming little picnic area. So what I like to do is, like, go into the town square. There are lots of little cafes and little bakeries, too, and you can pick up sandwiches and things like that. And have yourself a little picnic at one of these places, you know. Then maybe go to Robert Hall. He does a wonderful Rhone blends, known for very good Rhone blends. Then up the street is Eberle Winery, very well known. And he's one of the pioneers of the Syrah blend and Syrah grape and Rhone blends. And if you're lucky on a certain weekend, he could be out there in the parking lot, Gary Eberle, the owner. He's got a big one of the Santa Maria-style barbecues, and he's out there barbecuing. And you can just have smell the aroma down on 46 East, you know. And then around the corner from their 46 East is a charming little winery called Bianchi. And it's set around a lovely man-made lake, a small little lake. Beautiful architecture and great wines, great Chardonnays, very good Zinfandels. So that's around the route of 46 East. And to stay, the, of course, the Paso Robles Inn is great because it's right in the town square and you can walk to little tasting rooms and bars. Vinoteca is a lovely bar where you can sample local wines. You can go to restaurants like Via Creek.
And what about farmers markets? Do they have a farmers market
yes,
there on the
do.
Weekend?
Now, the most my most favorite farmers market, and I think it's the best up and down the coast, is Templeton Farmers Market. Some of the best produce, great breads, meats. They even have a little animal petting zoo. You can take your kids.
How far away is Templeton from Paso Robles?
Templeton is like a 5-minute drive, 5 to 10. It's like two exits away. And it's a tiny little ghost town. I call it a town that time forgot. It's so charming. It's just quiet. And yet they have a couple of great restaurants. They have the McPhee's Grill by Ian McPhee, which is a real hangout.
I want to go now. Now, let's say that we're having the kind of week where we're really pressed for time. We have a lot of things, but we just have to get out of town for a day. Where can we go just for the day?
Just for the day, then I think the Santa Ynez area is more accessible. It's about a 2-2.5 hour drive. You can start early in the morning and go to at least 3-4 wineries, have lunch at Los Olivos. There's some charming restaurants. There's a Los Olivos Cafe. My favorite is, this is what I do. I go to Panino Cafe. They have great sandwiches, salads. I pick up some lunch there and then go to one of the wineries, do a little tasting. And most of the wineries, they have beautiful picnic grounds, so you can really enjoy that. And then maybe end your day, if you can get reservations, have dinner at the Ballard Inn restaurant. So you can have dinner there and head back, you know, have an early dinner, 6-7 o'clock. And the wineries I would choose to go, I love the Santa Rita Hills because I love the Pinot Noirs there. And you can visit wineries like La Fond, Melville, fantastic Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, Babcock next door. Those three are very good. And Foley's, a new tasting room winery that's come up next to near Melville. So you can taste that. You can go to Buttonwood next door. Summertime, they have a great peach farm there, and they have a great peach stand. So you can pick a basket of peaches there, too.
And get wine to put the peaches in.
And okay, exactly. Yes, yes.
Well, thank you so much, Mira. I'm glad that you took the time to write this book.
Thank you for having me.
California's Central Coast, the ultimate winery guide from Santa Barbara to Paso Robles, is Mira Advani Honeycutt's book. It's a wonderful guide to this new region. Sign up for our weekly Good Food newsletter and find each week's show. You can stream Good Food, podcast Good Food, and watch episodes as well. Find it all on kcrw.com/goodfood. The show's produced by Thea Challoner with Bob Carlson, Candace Moyer, Connie Alvarez, and Holly Tarson. The music supervisor is Gary Messiha. Special thanks to Beth Xavier. I'm Evan Kleiman. Join us next week for another edition of Good Food.